ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In a tiny Victorian town, the football club isn't just a weekend ritual.
It's country footy, you get there really early, you leave late.
But then, one day, something happens.
In the back of a caravan, just over the road from this footy club.
Once I realised what was going to happen, it was not good.
And suddenly, everyone must pick a side.
I just felt angry. Those folks were meant to be my mates.
Hometown Boys, a new series by Background Briefing. Listen now on the ABC Listen app.
Give the call to the Honourable the Prime Minister.
Matilda. Edith Brutman. Dan Al-Khayyam. Boris and Sophia Gurman. Alexander Kleitman. Rabbi Yaakov Levitan. Peter Maher. Reuven Morrison. Marika Pugani. Rabbi Eli Schlanger. Adam Smythe. Boris Tettelroyd, Tanya Tretiak, Tibor Whiteson. Mr. Speaker.
Parliament is back earlier than expected after the worst terrorist attack ever on Australian soil. Representatives from across the country have descended on Canberra this morning to deal with anti-Semitism and gun laws. The goal is to work through the proposed response to the Bondi terror attack. But bipartisanship looks like it was falling apart. Perhaps it's coming back on the rails. There's been an intense debate and already a stripping back of some of those laws. So where will the political wheeling and dealing land? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelas.
And I'm Claire Armstrong.
Claire, we're back in Canberra together in Parliament House, two sitting days which are intense. They've already been intense. One of the key reasons for the early return has already been addressed. In fact, it was, and let's begin there, a really emotional morning in the Parliament. I found it really emotional to watch. A condolence motion for the victims of the Bondi terrorist attack on December the 14th. But the big question, of course, still looms. What will the legislation look like? But Claire, I want just to talk about day one first, before we get to the argy-bargy in the legislation and the negotiations that are currently going on. The condolence motion opened with a minute's silence, but it was quite moving. Walk me through what you saw.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those moments that we had on the podcast last week. A colleague, Charles Croucher, said would be an opportunity for healing, and I think that's what we saw this morning. We had that minute of silence. The names of the 15 people who were killed in that attack were read out in the public gallery. There were family members and other loved ones of the people that were killed. And then we had these series of really powerful speeches, I felt, from the Prime Minister, the opposition leader, Leader of the Nationals, Deputy PM, Allegra Spender, of course, being the local member of Wentworth. Bondi is in her electorate. And some really incredible contributions from some of the more senior Jewish members of the Parliament. Former Attorney General Mark Dreyfus, really brought several people in the room to tears, did tear up himself. Julian Lisa from the Coalition, all speaking very much from the heart, trying to acknowledge everything that this community, the Jewish Australian community, has been feeling, this sense of being targeted, but really sending a message of support on behalf of the nation. It was really the Parliament at its best, in my view, and very moving.
It was really moving. The Prime Minister essentially taking responsibility in his speech, saying responsibility starts with me. And I think they're the words that a Prime Minister should use and were powerfully delivered. Mark Dreyfus, for me, was a standout, obviously a very senior Jewish MP for Labor. Speaking in Hebrew in the Parliament, it was really a powerful moment. He got choked up and it was pretty emotional. I think the other standout for me was Allegra Spender. She gave such a powerful speech about that day as well. And so, yeah, you're right. It was the Parliament at its best, and it was broadly the right tone. I think Susan Lee strayed a little bit into political territory. I think you have to always be very careful in condolence motions. There is a line. Of course, the Parliament should be a theatre of debate and getting the laws right. I'm a big advocate of that, but, you know, she did sort of criticise the Prime Minister in her speech in the condolence motion, and I sort of wondered about that.
I think what I've observed over this summer has been that it is very difficult in some instances, or people have found it difficult to separate the politics from this incident. It was inherently political before it occurred, this issue. And yeah, the fact that that strayed into the condolence motion, I have seen it before in different condolence motion settings, but it did stand out to compared to some of the other contributions that had been made.
Yeah, I found it a little bit jarring. That's not to say the Prime Minister shouldn't be criticised. That's not what I'm saying about how long it took him. She mentioned how long it took with the Royal Commission, but I wasn't sure that...
A lot of avenues you can do that. Yeah.
And it's been said, but this was condolences for, you know, the families. And it's not just the people who've died. It's so many other people who are affected and all the Jewish people around the country who are genuinely, as we've said on this podcast, and I can't say it enough because I've been told and I hear it, they're generally terrified. Ongoing terror. It's not as if terror is a one-day event or it just affects the, you know, the 15 victims who died. There are the injured and then there are the affected communities. So today we're recording on a Monday, beginning the political week. Yeah, very much a day of reflection. But that now we're going to go to where it goes next, because backtracking, Saturday the Prime Minister calls a press conference. He stands in the Prime Minister's courtyard. He announces what really is a back down from the government, one based on the hardcore arithmetic of the parliament, which is that they could not get their omnibus bill through. There was no way they were going to get that through. They had the objection of the Greens and the objection of the coalition on different elements.
The two pathways through the Senate.
So there is no way. So pragmatism has to be the prevailing way that they operate. They split the bill, but they also, so gun laws look likely, Claire, to be passed with the support of the Greens, and it'll be interesting to see how the coalition ends up positioning, because they've been pretty hardcore on the gun reforms, and a watering down of the hate laws as well. So they actually did tell us that they had a different position on hate laws.
Yeah, so I think what will be really interesting is, firstly, as you say, where the coalition lands on gun laws. The kind of straw that broke this back on Saturday was the Greens saying, you've got us for the gun laws. I think that was the impetus for the split more than anything, that you've got a guarantee of getting half of this legislative package through. On hate speech, the removal of the new offence to criminalise inciting hatred or promoting hatred, I think it became obvious as we heard from experts that this was a complex, we already knew it was a complex area of law, but it was one that required more thought. The other components of that bill, the creation of a regime to list hate organisations, stronger powers for the Home or Immigration Minister around visa cancellations and decisions, those things suggest to me they are issues that the coalition talks about a lot. There's probably space to get agreement there. That's certainly the position of the coalition as far as conversations have gone this morning. The question is whether there's the goodwill left between these two kind of sparring parties that have really struggled to find any common ground in the last 4 weeks.
So I think it's really interesting that the coalition, that Susan Lee, who told us that the bill was unsalvageable and was pretty hard line, now is now negotiating, right? Now, to be fair, the bill is different than when she said it was unsalvageable. So we're not comparing apples with apples. Okay, so let's accept that she would say, if she was here, she were randomly invited into the podcast, hang on a minute, I'm talking about something else. So now she's negotiating to pass watered down legislation. You know, you will see, guys, who you're listening, whether this works out for her. But this is a bit of a gamble for her. Now, if she's doing that, that means, and I'm going to speak to him a little later on ABC News, someone like John O'Donoghue, who's a leading conservative, has come on board with her to find a way through, because they have made the assessment, some of the conservatives, that because they were so hardline right after Bondi, they have to show, which I think is right politically, some attempt at, you know, coming up with some laws that address these issues, but they didn't want to criminalise speech, and that's been taken out by the government. Okay. But I don't know if this is going to make the Matt Canavans of the world. He's a National. Andrew Hastie, the leading insurgent, you know, kind of candidate that is up against Susan Lee, satisfied, or if this is going to be an easy transaction for her, even if it's watered down. What do you think?
I agree. The process that we are in at the moment is essentially Susan and the Prime Minister have met this morning. Susan's given some requests around slight changes, particularly to some of the criminal law amendments. There's some aggravating offences. There's also the coalition very keen on that hate listing organisation regime to make sure it's very focused on serious incitement to violence and hatred. They want to target groups who are sort of structurally and organisationally promoting, inciting violence and contributing to hate and anti-Semitism. They don't want any old organisation that maybe has someone who says things that fall on one side of the law to then result in the entire organisation being listed. They, to me, on face value, seem pretty reasonable. The Prime Minister's gone away to consider those. We'll come back with a position. If those things are agreed to, Susan then goes to the party room, the broader party room. And I think that's really where the work starts for her. And I think that she is in a position at the moment, a point in her leadership, where Susan Lee could come along and give 110% performance and there would be people in her party room who would say, why didn't she give 111?
Yep.
And that is a very difficult starting point to try and build consensus, even before you get into the fact that, as you say, you've got people in this party room who have real ideological kind of concerns as soon as you go anywhere near hate speech. So I think it's imperative on Susan, particularly given that she said in her condolence motion, even one of the things that she was hearing a lot from the community was, we don't necessarily want your words, we want action. It's an opportunity to be a part of action. And I think to an extent there's a possibility that there will be individuals crossing the floor. That is obviously allowed in the opposition when it's the coalition. You don't get punished necessarily for that in the way that you would if it was Labor. But it's really in Susan's interest to try and prevent that from happening.
It is in her interest, and you're right about the 110 to 111%, beautifully put, because that's true. She's in almost a lose-lose situation, right? So she's now working out how to navigate her way through, and she's making the assessment that after speaking so forcefully about the government needing to recall Parliament by the end of last year by calling for big laws, to not look like she's even negotiating with the Prime Minister looks pretty weird, and she's right to make that assessment. In fact, she should have made that assessment last week and not been so spooked by people like Andrew Hastie, because he will always say things that perhaps she won't agree with. That will always, you know, you can assume that. Bake it into your equation at the moment. That's just the way it's rolling for her, and you can't stop that, I don't think, by, you know, capitulating too early.
Yes, and I would go back and say that perhaps the coalition was a bit distracted by the fact that the Prime Minister presented this as an omnibus bill with the gun laws and the hate speech together. There was lots of complaining about this being a wedge. It obviously was a wedge, but it was also the starting point of negotiations.
It was both.
Given that the Greens went through a sort of consultative negotiation process and said, our outcome is we will only support one component of this bill, and the Prime Minister said, okay. There's not really any reason to think that, as much as it would have pained him, that the coalition might not have arrived at that exact outcome for themselves if they had taken that approach early on and negotiated. So, yes, there was an attempt to wedge. I think the coalition got very animated about criticising that wedge rather than using the power that they had as obviously an ability to get something through the Senate to actually get meaningful legislation that they wanted.
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, the government is saying if things don't pass, it's the opposition's fault. That's their positioning. The opposition is saying government is responsible for Jewish Australians' anxiety. I think that's kind of the framing here. So who's winning the kind of politics here, the fight in the public eye? If they don't pass the laws, who gets damaged by that? I mean, my view, I asked you a question, I'm answering, and it's kind of both.
Yeah, it's a pox on both your houses situation, I think, and for different ways. ultimately, you know, the Prime Minister bears more responsibility for outcomes in Parliament because they're the party, he leads the government. Labor are the party of government. They have an opportunity and an obligation to work with the Parliament that Australians provide them and get meaningful legislation passed. And if this doesn't work, I do think, you know, hearing the Prime Minister this morning say, well, you know, we're not in the business of putting bills up and just having them fail over and over again. If this doesn't get through, we probably won't revisit it this term. I'm not sure that that is, like, I get that that's a bit of bluster. Obviously, you're at this point in the negotiations where you kind of want to have the threat of nothing being achieved hanging over your opponent, but that is not a helpful way to approach, particularly when we are, once again, where we started this podcast, talking about legislation born out of an immense tragedy and a horrific incident. And this isn't politics as usual. It should never have been politics as usual. But equally for Susan Lee, at that point in her leadership, to not be able to deliver any legislation or any change to this community that she's
championed.
She's here to represent and be here on behalf of. We've had members of the Jewish community say in Australia saying, like, you know, please don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Please, let's get something done. We will take something over nothing. That would reflect quite poorly, I think, on Susan as much as the Prime Minister if they can't sort this out.
As you and I have written and we've spoken about across the week, the opposition was calling, of course, for Royal Commission early on. It took a while for the government to get there. Now we've got, in some ways, Claire, the results, if we can call them that, as sort of whatever that means. It's a bit odd to frame it that way, but I have now, of how all of that period went. So we've got the news poll, which was a diabolical outcome, far away from an election. Want to make it clear, it ain't just because people park with someone doesn't mean they will vote that way, but One Nation ahead of the coalition. When I saw that, when that dropped, and I'm kind of one of those people who likes to see news poll within a minute of it being published because, you know, that's 25 years I've done that. I could believe it, but I also couldn't believe it, Claire. That is very significant. And the reason I mention it is it's very linked to the way they're positioning around all of this.
Yeah, I mean, that result, and again, it's a snapshot in time. I don't even like saying if people voted for today, this is how they would vote, because obviously the stakes are very different answering a polling question than they are going into a ballot box. But on face value, that's 1 in 5 Australians at this point saying that they would look to One Nation as their preferred party that they would vote for.
1 in 5 Australians.
And nationally, we know that polling as something like One Nation is a bit like the Greens. It doesn't really matter at a national level because it's about where that is concentrated. And if you're not getting a concentration in seats that you can then win, it's sort of just a protest vote that's flat across the board. But yes, getting into that level of double-digit territory and at the expense of the coalition is an extraordinary electoral situation, and one that, you know, it's the first poll that's sort of shown this. Others aren't quite showing One Nation taking over the coalition, but there is clearly a trend. And for me, I find it's a bit of a chicken and egg question, because there is obviously a potent right flank of the coalition. I shouldn't even say flank. It's almost the majority of the party room who feel that the party is losing votes to One Nation because they're not being right enough.
But within that conservative grouping, there are different tendencies.
There are. And so you could argue, well, this proves them right. Here's this migration of votes. But there are also a lot of members of the coalition and their supporters who are out there constantly criticising Susan Lee for not being right enough and almost like putting that idea into people's heads in the first place and propagating the fact that they almost believe that they don't represent that cohort of Australians. And that could explain why people are shifting as well. So it is an interesting phenomenon. It may not be borne out in a federal election.
Yeah. Well, it's a long way away.
But big problem for Susan trying to have these arguments in her party room.
It's a huge problem for Susan Lee. That's the thing. When I saw that, I thought, because there was another poll, Resolve poll by Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, which showed the Prime Minister really struggling enormously in the polls.
Well, they both show that.
Yeah, right, they do. Sorry, yeah, absolutely. But I mean, that was the first thing that dropped. And you'd think that puts a lot of pressure on the Prime Minister. But then the One Nation story really ends up being more dominant because you can see the pathway because of preferential voting for the Prime Minister. The pathway for Susan Lee is more difficult, right, when this is happening. And it puts more pressure on her from the people like Andrew Hastie when polling is like this. You know, when it shows One Nation is doing so well compared to her. And yet, you know, as you say, it's circular. If she chases it, it does some more damage to her in the centre. But if she doesn't, like, nod to any of it, it means internally she's under incredible pressure from her party room that she's not taking some of these threats seriously. It's kind of, again, it's a lose-lose for her.
Yes, and I think what the numbers are interesting in showing is the Prime Minister's suffered in his personal ratings. Labor have taken a big haircut on their primary, but the coalition hasn't capitalized on that. So to be hemorrhaging seemingly simultaneously by not be appealing to the center and collecting disaffected Labor votes, but also losing to your right to One Nation, that is a bad position to be in, because you could justify to a party room, look, we're going to let some people go to One Nation because look at all this ground we have to gain by attacking Labor in the centre, but they're losing on both fronts. Mm.
Look, at the same time, I mean, I broke a story yesterday about Peter Dutton threatening essentially to sue the Liberal Party.
It was a great yarn.
Thank you. It was a good story because when I heard it, my brain nearly blew again. And, you know, I spoke to seriously more than 10 people. It's the most well-sourced story you'll ever read. Like, it was not contested at all, my friend. And he says sections of this are defamatory. And now they've had to press stop on their election review to get legal advice, to manage the former leader, who clearly he believes was not treated well through the process. Now, he was interviewed once. There was no follow-up. He has said to the Liberal executive he does not think that's acceptable. And so, you know, that's a really interesting political story. But it is all in parallel with the problems inside the Liberal Party. What it tells me, Claire, and I want your thoughts on this, is that this is still a party at war with itself.
Yes, I think we are still seeing the results of the 2022 election loss, where because Peter Dutton gained momentum quite quickly and then that built through the period of the referendum defeat, there wasn't that bloodletting, that self-reflection, but also the acknowledgement of deep structural problems at a party level and all of these other things that were allowed to sort of be pushed to one side in the name of unity and progressing forward and making some pretty serious inroads. There were a few times there it got pretty scary for Anthony Albanese, even just in the polls. He obviously pulled it back significantly. And now we've compounded that with an even greater loss in 2025. And I think in my mind, there are probably a lot of people who quite reasonably want to have some serious conversations that weren't properly had the first time around, feel that it's imperative to do so now. But obviously, there is also a preservation instinct, and the easiest way to preserve is to throw the previous administration completely under the bus and have them kind of carry the can for all of those failures, which, as I just said, probably predate Peter Dutton's leadership. So I do think a lot of these unresolved issues, they should come to a head. Clearly, it hasn't been managed well. Peter Dutton is of the view, as per your reporting, that it hasn't been managed well. This is probably the last opportunity for them to get that right, have a serious, meaningful review, try to do some of those structural party changes, you know, even just modernising the party. You often hear about how far behind the coalition feel their machine is compared to the well kind of honed, oiled operation that is the Labor Party. And, you know, maybe this legal challenge situation does result in the final product not, for want of a better term, naming and shaming individuals in Peter Dutton's office and all of those kinds of niche political issues, but it still needs, I think, to be pretty intensely focused on where things were going wrong.
Yeah, I think that's right. Just finally, just 2 days of sitting, that's not long. What else could we expect in the next period?
I'm really interested. There'll be a question time on Tuesday. I'm really interested to see the mood of I always love watching the backbenchers and how engaged they are and the way that hour is progressing, whether they feel that they're in a position of strength or weakness, because I think that then sets up the contest for what we're going to see when Parliament resumes in full in February. You know, without Bondi, we would have been expecting to have a coalition-led debate on immigration. Labor were getting to be under pressure on gambling reform. There are these long-term pernicious kind of issues that you need to be able to have those arguments from a position of strength and unity. And so I'll be looking to how the mood is on the floor of the Parliament tomorrow as a way of sort of getting a sense of who I think might be feeling in a position to have some of those tougher fights when we're back for real in February.
Back for real. But I suspect even when we're back for real, all the other fights, you know, this because we've got this Royal Commission, this is now baked into our political discourse, isn't it? This is
Yeah. There'll be all these inflection points as that Royal Commission goes along, ministers potentially getting called as witnesses, interim reports, the final report. This is now a definitely, as you say, a constant parallel for this term of Parliament.
Absolutely. Claire, it's so great to be able to pick your brain and you talk to me today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for Politics Now today. Tomorrow, Raph Epstein is back with me for 2026 to help unpack day two of this special early sitting week. He already spoke to the Prime Minister today, so he's all over it. And remember, Fran and I love getting your questions for the Party Room. We're back together on Thursday, so send us those voice notes to theparty room@abc.net.au. See ya.